his teaching. For our purposes this morning, we're going to look briefly at two. First, in Matthew 20, the parable of the crazy farmer. As you recall, it's harvest time, work is plentiful, and every morning the farmer goes out to the marketplace, which is the hiring hall of his day, like manpower today, to recruit workers for his fields. Now, given the time of year and the amount of work available, one can assume, at least the great Lutheran biblical scholar Jeremias, as we can assume, that those who were still idling today with small talk at the 11th hour, 5 in the afternoon, were lazy and a shiftless bunch. We can further assume that the 11th hour workers took their time getting out to the field, shuffled around a lot, did very little work. But at pay time, they received a full day's pay. Now, those who heard Jesus tell the story found that his ending had a sharp twist. In this familiar rabbinic parable, meaning other rabbis of Jesus' time had told a similar story, in their version, those who worked the 1 hour got the whole day's pay because they worked so hard in the 1 hour. But in the version of Jesus, the emphasis is not on the diligence of the workers, but on the gratuitous generosity of the farmer. It was a mad, crazy, insanely generous act. No farmer or businessman in the year 2006 can indulge in such reckless generosity, remain in business very long. Suppose you own a company with 100 workers, and 90 of them work a 40-hour week. The other 10 come in Friday afternoon at 4 in the afternoon. They work 1 hour till 5, and then at pay time, you give them all the same wage of $2,000 for their week's work. Your partners, your colleagues, even your family would say, your cheese just slid off your cracker. You're not playing with a full deck, man. I mean, that is not only crazy, that's unjust. And that's the response of the workers in Matthew 20. They go to the farmer and say, see here, this is grossly unfair. We were out there all day long in the scorching heat. Now you give these latecomers the same wage as us. That is unjust. And the farmer replies, my friends, I do you no injustice. Did we not agree to the wage of $1 a day? Take your pay and go. Am I not free to do as I like with what's my own? Or are you envious because I'm generous? I'm telling you, the last will be first, and the first last. As I travel around the country, speaking in a wide ecumenical setting of churches, from very rarely Roman Catholic, but Southern Baptist, Methodist, Lutheran, Presbyterian, Moravian, Quaker, and countless evangelical churches, colleges and university campuses, I'm appalled by the number of American Christians who are scandalized by the generosity of God. We're in, they're out. By God, they're out. In the last play that he wrote before his death, the great French playwright Jean Arnoul describes the last judgment as he sees it. The good guys, the just, are standing before the gate of heaven. They're keyed up, bursting with impatience, sharing their reserved seats. They can't wait to go marching in when suddenly a rumor starts. Look. Look. He's going to forgive them, too. What? Then, after all I've been through, they get forgiven? I can't believe it. Exasperated, they work themselves into a fury, and they start cursing God. And that was the last judgment, you see. They judged themselves, excommunicated themselves. God appeared in Jesus in the form of an infinite, boundless, extravagant mercy, and they refused to acknowledge him. I want nothing to do with the heaven who's open every Tom, Dick, and Harry. I spurn this so-called Messiah who's letting them all off. And because they could not transcend the limitations of their own finite expectations of who the Messiah should be, they could not recognize him in Jesus. And the same theme is replayed in what the scholars call the pearl of the parables. As you recall in Luke 15, the prodigal son is off in a life of waste and wandering, boozing and womanizing, and returns home, not to the expected condemnation, but to a merciful acquittal, as his father goes running, stumbling, falling down the road. And when he sees his wasted son, he does not demand, "Where you been? What have you been up to?" But he falls on his neck, kisses him, covers him with a new robe, new ring on his finger, new sandals on his feet, then says, "Kill the fatted calf. We're going to party for 14 days. Hardly an appropriate way to treat a delinquent kid. I mean, the kid is spoiled rotten in the beginning. You spoil him again, he's never going to change. That's crazy behavior. Have you ever identified with the older brother in the story? Muttering to himself, "That rat Fink didn't come back till he's good and ready. All the time I stay home, fattening this calf that my father's never going to roast for that dork." I mean, I believe being kind too, but it's off the wall. My father's wacko. At any rate, the older brother, a serious, hardworking young man, didn't like it one bit. He saw his father's love, and it made him angry. He saw his father's indiscriminate compassion, and he resented it. If you ever have the opportunity to spend Easter in France, whether you're in a large metropolitan area like Paris, Bordeaux, Dijon, or a little village like I lived in for 6 months, Saint-Rémy in the forest of Bourgogne, on Easter morning, you'll see this one phrase written on the sides of buildings, it's on the backs of buses, it's in block print, it's in script, it's graffiti. But the same phrase is sung, recited, chanted in all the Christian churches. In fact, on Easter morning, when Christians pass